Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jenny Nielsen with Grantmakers of Western PA. Thanks for joining us for this session. Sorry to start things off with a little technical glitch there, but we're getting things worked out. This is the fifth in the series of the Keystone Policy Series. It's a series that's been developed by Grantmakers of Western Pennsylvania and Philanthropy Network Greater Philadelphia, an effort to share with Pennsylvania funders how their colleagues are working on selected statewide policy issues. Before I start, I just want to cover a couple of housekeeping items. During today's call, all the lines except for those speaking will be muted, so just so we don't get any ambient noise or distractions. At the end of the call, we will open for questions, and during that time, you can click Raise Your Hand in the lower left hand of your screen. I'll identify the names of those hands raised, and when your name is called, just unmute by pressing *7. After asking your question, we just ask that you remember to press *6 to remute your line. You can also type a question at any time in the lower left-hand side. Also in the lower left-hand side, there's a chat box, so we welcome you to type a question at any time throughout the call. And finally, I just wanted to let you know that the call is being recorded. The recording will be available as a resource after the call on Grantmakers of Western Pennsylvania and Philanthropy Network of Greater Philadelphia website for members only. Today's session is focused on combating Pennsylvania's opioid epidemic. We're joined today by Joe Pyle, president of the Scattergood Foundation, Joni Schwager, executive director of the Staunton Farm Foundation, and Brendan Saloner, who is at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to you, Joe. Joe's going to start us out with some background information to help frame today's discussion.
Sure. First of all, I want to thank everybody on such a beautiful day after several days of rain across the state for being on the call today, and also for having as diverse a group participate in the call. And I think that by way of introduction, I think that if we're a funder in the state of Pennsylvania, regardless of our area of focus, the opioid crisis is affecting our community. And I feel like over the last 6 months, we've been very fortunate to connect with folks down at Johns Hopkins, particularly the director of the program that Brendan is involved in, Colleen Berry, who has authored a paper on the opioid crisis for the foundation, which we will make available to all of you after the call. But I think the best thing is to turn the presentation over to Brendan and have him get started so that we have plenty of time at the end of the call for questions and exchange. So, Brendan, can you take us away?
Sure. Can everyone hear me? I hope so. It's really a delight to join you all today, and thank you for the introduction. So as the title of my presentation suggests, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the dimensions of this important public health crisis, but I also really want to hit on some of the potential solutions. This is indeed a crisis of unprecedented proportions, but what I want to leave you all with today is a feeling like there are a lot of things that can be done, and there are a lot of effective policy tools at our disposal. So I'm hoping that we will be leaving this call with a feeling of potential optimism that things can get better. So just to make this issue vivid in a way that I know that you all see in the newspapers, and on television, I just pulled a bunch of headlines from the Pennsylvania news media from the last few months. Literally, these are just stories that have been in the press talking about some issues related to the opioid epidemic across the state. And I know that we all see and feel and experience that there is a real crisis going on right now. And so In the midst of a crisis, I think it's often difficult to really take a step back and think about things from the evidence base and from a kind of a higher level related to public health, and also to think about sustained change. But I really want to focus our thinking today around sustained solutions, not just things that might have a payoff this week or this year, or really to think about what we can do to change the trajectory of the epidemic long term. And I just want to say as a prefacing comment that the remarks that I'm going to be providing today are coming from a public health perspective. So when we think about things from a public health perspective, I think the key point that kind of animates our thinking is really what are the greatest harms and what are the opportunities to reduce the different risks associated with those harms from a population perspective. So we try to be non-ideological. We try to go where the scientific evidence takes us. And I think importantly what you'll see is that we try not to put all of our eggs in any one basket, because to really address this multifaceted crisis, we're going to need multifaceted solutions. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't at least say something, although I don't have much time to get into great detail about how we got here. It's a long conversation, but I do want to hit on a few points. So if you go back to the 1980s, one thing that you'll see is that there was a recognition that as a country we weren't doing enough to recognize pain as chronic pain as an important issue facing many patients. And so there was a real desire to change prescribing practices that in many cases came from a very well-intentioned place. The problem is that the harms associated with opioid medications were not very well understood at that time, and the addictive potential of these drugs was also not well understood a couple decades ago. And so what happened is that the rate of prescriptions went up without really thinking about what the long-term consequences are. Now, this crisis has then been magnified many-fold by the greater availability on the streets of cheap and highly potent heroin, and more recently synthetic opioids like fentanyl, which is a drug that I'll definitely talk about in a minute. And then, you know, you have to place these issues within a larger social and economic framework. What we can see from recent research is that the epidemic really follows a trail of despair. So it's been hitting populations and communities that have been most hard hit by a bad economy, by changing structure of opportunity, by a lot of things that are symptomatic of deeper social and economic woes. So thinking about a way out of the opioid epidemic, I think, requires us to not only think about the medical perspective, but other kinds of social and economic dimensions. And then finally, we have to think about this as an issue that is often framed in terms of law and order and the criminal justice system, but criminalization of drug use also has important implications for whether people are able to get the help that they need. So these, I've become almost softened to seeing these pictures, but they really are very striking. What you can see is that drug overdose is the leading cause of injury death in the U.S. It's overtaken motor vehicle accidents. There are these data are a little old. There are now over 50,000 people who die every year from drug overdose, and most overdoses now are related to opioids. So now when we look at the breakdown of drug overdoses, what you can see is that green line at the top showing any opioids has really been going up threefold since the early 2000s, and it's the rate of increase has been accelerating in a very troubling manner in the last few years. But what's interesting is that what you also see is a leveling off of the overdose rate associated with commonly prescribed opioids. So there's a little bit of good news. Where you see the greatest concern is that overdoses related to heroin and to so-called synthetic opioids, especially fentanyl, which is a drug that has a legitimate medical purpose but which can be illicitly manufactured and which is oftentimes as much as 100 times more potent than heroin, has been really contributing to a huge amount of the death burden associated with the opioid epidemic. So this is really where the epidemic gets most troubling right now. And then when you think about the demographics of this epidemic, especially in a state like Pennsylvania, what you can recognize is that there are long-standing issues in low-income and minority communities, especially in the African-American community related to heroin use in inner city communities, but the recent opioid epidemic has also been affecting more middle class white communities as well. And so you can see that the rate of increase both among white men and white women has been really marked in the last decade. And especially thinking about this in a diverse state like Pennsylvania, it's important to realize that this epidemic does not look the same in urban and rural communities. So when we think about what the epidemic looks like in rural areas, there's a few hallmark features to really pay attention to. One is the increased sales of opioid analgesics, opioid medications, so those are drugs like oxycodone and OxyContin, in rural areas that led to a great amount of the drug being available and therefore being diverted from legitimate medical use to non-medical use. Then you also have to think about how this relates to long-standing demographic changes in these communities, like upwardly mobile young adults moving from areas where there's economic deprivation and leaving behind a lot of individuals who might be in the higher risk group for drug use. A lot of things that we think of as being sources of strength in rural communities also may be inadvertently sources of concern for the opioid epidemic, like a mentality of caring for other people and making sure that they're, if they're experiencing things like chronic pain, that they get medication from friends and family. Well, those kinship and social networks are generally a positive thing, but they do become a source of diffusion of prescription opioids among people who are at risk. And then, as I mentioned before, there are these issues related to economic deprivation and unemployment, which are stressors, and we know that those stressors increase the probability that people will engage in harmful use. Now, you know, the focus right now is on overdose, but I just want to highlight that the burden of the epidemic goes far beyond just fatal overdoses. There's many people who don't overdose but still experience a lot of problems related to non-medical use of prescription opioids, heroin use. People may overdose and never die. People may experience other kinds of injuries that are not overdoses, but which have a profound negative impact on their lives. And the opioid epidemic intersects in very important ways with other health challenges. So what we know from the research is that opioid use disorder is highly comorbid with people who have drinking problems, who use benzodiazepine medications. So these are often drugs that are used to deal with anxiety or other kinds of psychiatric issues, and a variety of other substances like stimulants. And the combination of use of those drugs with opioids actually creates a greater potential that someone is going to overdose and ultimately die. Conversely, people who have opioid use disorders are more likely to have a variety of other kinds of chronic illnesses that may themselves be caused by their use of opioids. So hepatitis C, HIV related to injection drug use, and then a variety of other sequelae related to just long-term use of opioids, such as kidney disease. So I now want to turn and talk about Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is right at the top of the states. This is not a good ranking to have, unfortunately. So Pennsylvania ranks sixth in the drug overdose in the country. The rate of overdose has grown a lot since 2010. And if you look at the people who are dying from drug overdose in Pennsylvania, what you see is that they skew predominantly male, predominantly white, and tend to be concentrated in the age groups between roughly age 25 and 44. Now, this number really stuck out to me. If you look at the top 10 drugs that were present among overdose victims, what you can see is that fentanyl is now ranking number one in Pennsylvania ahead of heroin in terms of positive confirmation that this was a drug present in somebody's body at the time that they overdosed. So fentanyl, as I said, is highly lethal, often not understood by the person using the drug to be present in the drugs that they're using. People may be habituated to using heroin and taking a dose that they think is safe for them based on their use of heroin, only to realize that that they have taken fentanyl instead, which is much more likely to lead to the catastrophic outcome of a fatal overdose. And then if we think about this epidemic across the different regions of Pennsylvania, what you can see is that it's also an epidemic that has multiple epicenters. So Philadelphia County with an overdose rate right there at the top, but you also see areas in the west of the state where there's large clusters of overdoses. So this is really, as I said, an epidemic that has both an urban and a rural dimension, and I think that that's critical in thinking about solutions. And that leads me right into talking about some potential areas of solution. So if prescribing practices got us here, changing prescribing practices are clearly something that's going to be important to how we address the epidemic. I think the key challenge, and one that should not be discounted, is that many patients have real chronic pain, and they need help managing that pain. The problem is that prescribing those patients opioid medications can often lead to misuse and to those drugs being diverted to other people who are not the targeted patient. And so, you know, the challenge here is how can we continue to promote access to opioid medications, especially for short periods of time when they may be effective. We have good evidence that when you start someone off on a high dose of an opioid medication, that can affect their subsequent trajectory. They're going to come back and fill more prescriptions and fill them at higher doses. And so this has led to a change in clinical guidelines. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put out some guidelines last year, and kind of the catchphrase there is start low and go slow. So when prescribing drugs, if possible, start patients with a relatively conservative dose. Don't send them home with 30 days of medication that they may not need and which will end up in their medicine cabinet. We all know of people, maybe we are people, who have in our homes opioid medicines just sitting around that someone could come and take and use for non-medical purposes. And then I think also beyond thinking about limiting the supply of opioids, it's important to think about non-opioid alternatives. So what are other ways that we can put into clinical practice to reduce people's dependence on opioid medications? There's non-opioid pain medications, which may be effective for some patients, but there's also a variety of other kinds of interventions that are sometimes quite effective at improving people's pain management over the long term. And then when we think about this at a systems level, it's also important to think about prescription drug monitoring programs. So for those of you who are not familiar, a PDMP is a state registry of controlled substances. And so PDMPs, which are present in 49 states, operate in such a way that whenever a prescriber prescribes a controlled substance like an opioid or a stimulant or a benzodiazepine, that prescription record goes into a portal. And the hope is that if you create this portal, that physicians can then query the portal and identify people who are at high risk of either misuse or some other kind of adverse event, and then improve care for the patients who are in the high-risk group. Getting to a point where the PDMP is an effective tool for clinical intervention is not straightforward, however, and I think that there's been a lot of growing pains as states are trying to make greater use of their PDMP programs. Part of this is getting physicians to actually use the PDMP. What we've discovered here in Maryland is that although all prescribers are required to participate in the PDMP, actual use of the PDMP for clinical practice has been relatively slow. Now, in Pennsylvania, in 2016, a requirement came online requiring office-based prescribers to query the PDMP for each first opioid prescription for a patient. So each time that a patient starts opioids, a course of opioid medication treatment, and then for any time that the prescriber has a reasonable basis for concern about the patient. This is more stringent than what we've seen in other states. I certainly think that it's a worthwhile thing to try. I think that there's also a need for greater evidence about whether this is effective at achieving the outcomes that the state legislature hoped to see. This is my own area of interest, is increasing access to treatment. So stunningly, only about 1 in 10 people who have an opioid use disorder receive treatment in any given year. And this is this falls far below the standard of care of any other chronic illness that really you can think of. As a society, we would be shocked if we found out that only 1/10 of people with diabetes were receiving any treatment for diabetes, and yet we are dealing with an illness that is just as severe as just about any other chronic illness. When people do receive treatment, it's often received under a legal mandate, meaning that it's court-ordered, and they often don't get treatments that are evidence-based. And so here I really want to stress the importance of medication-assisted treatments. And the two most effective ones that we know about are buprenorphine, a drug that can be prescribed by office-based physicians who have a waiver from the federal government, and methadone, which can be prescribed for maintenance treatment from opioid treatment programs. Both buprenorphine and methadone carry a very strong evidence-based. They are gold standard treatments, and yet we find that there are still many communities in which there's no ability for patients to get into treatment programs for those medications. And indeed, what we see is that there are communities where people have to be placed on waiting lists. Now, when people are on waiting lists, they're often likely to disappear before treatment becomes available to them, or to have even worse things happen. So really what we should be trying to achieve is a situation where we have zero waiting lists. Now, how do we get to a place where we can really address the treatment gap? It's going to require multiple solutions. One is thinking about how we pay for treatment. So health insurance coverage is a big deal, getting private insurers to pay adequate rates for doctors to prescribe buprenorphine, or getting people into methadone maintenance programs, doing more through the Medicaid program to ensure that Medicaid-enrolled patients can get into treatment, and then also thinking about the supply of treatment providers. So opening up new facilities where people can get treated, or getting more physicians to prescribe buprenorphine to more patients. And I should mention that this is an area where there's been a lot of strong bipartisan agreement at the national level that we need to expand capacity. And so there have been some very promising pieces of federal legislation in the last couple years that are supporting the cause of increasing treatment capacity. So one thing to mention is that physicians can now prescribe buprenorphine to more patients than they were able to in the past, and there are grants coming through the federal government to all of the states to expand treatment programs, especially for patients who can't otherwise afford to get into treatment. So I think these are promising developments. They are also critically linked to health insurance access through the Affordable Care Act and to the Federal Mental Health and Addiction Parity Act. And so we really need to think about this in a sort of more holistic, comprehensive financing perspective. Building capacity is also a critical issue. thinking about states where there's a large rural population like Pennsylvania, we've seen some promising models like the hub and spoke model, which was pioneered in Vermont. Essentially, what the hub and spoke model allows you to do is it allows you to create a continuum of care between practices where buprenorphine is prescribed and opioid treatment programs where methadone is prescribed, so that there's a way to provide a pathway for patients to transition between those two levels of care depending on which kind of treatment is right for them, and also to provide more mentorship and support to community-based practices. Telemedicine is another area where there may be some opportunities to provide more contact with specialist providers in rural communities where there might not otherwise be physicians on hand. And then thinking about pathways to treatment from multiple places. So the idea being that when someone is identified in their primary care setting or in an emergency room as needing treatment, that we should be linking that person with treatment immediately. When you don't create that linkage, you don't create an opportunity for people to get into treatment. So desegregating medical care from the addiction treatment system is really a critical priority here. And then finally, there's a real stigma that still goes along with medication-assisted treatment. And we can't get serious about getting more people into medication-assisted treatment programs until we start addressing the stigma that goes along with those treatments and helping patients to feel like they are receiving a legitimate and medically important treatment is a key aspect of achieving this goal. So I know I'm going through these solutions quite quickly, so I welcome your questions and comments after these slides, but I do want to talk about harm reduction. Now, what is harm reduction? It means a lot of things to different people, but at its core, the idea is, well, even if you don't provide everyone with treatment, because not everybody who has an opioid use disorder may be committed or ready to go to treatment today, there's still a lot of ways that we can reduce the negative consequences of substance use. And we can do that through a variety of different tools, and all of those tools, I think, have a very strong basis in the public health literature. One of those tools is syringe and needle exchange. We know that, going back decades, that this is an effective way to cut down on bloodborne illnesses, and yet there's a lot of stigma still around the availability of needle exchange programs. And a lot of communities where these programs are needed don't have enough capacity to support needle exchange. And so we are experiencing a lot of unfortunate and totally avoidable spread of bloodborne illnesses right now because of inadequate supply of syringe and needle exchange programs. A little bit outside the box, and I'll talk about this one on the next slide, are safe consumption facilities. I'll just mention distribution of naloxone. So naloxone is the drug that reverses drug overdoses. This is a very, very effective treatment. It's being used by first responders. It can also be effectively used by family members and by friends of people who have opioid use disorders. And naloxone has been shown to save a lot of lives. And then spot testing for fentanyl is another kind of out-of-the-box idea, but which could be very effective at helping people to understand whether the drug that they've purchased on the street has any fentanyl present. If they know that, then they may change the way in which they use the drug, potentially reducing their risk of overdose. So just on this idea of safe consumption, what is safe consumption? The idea here is we can reduce the harms of street drug use by providing a place where people can use drugs under supervision. So the appeal here is that if someone is, let's say, injecting drugs in a safe consumption facility and they start to overdose, that there are staff who will be on hand who can help revive that person and prevent them from having a catastrophic outcome. Safe consumption actually is an idea that whose time has come in other countries. It's present in 11 countries, but it has not cut through in the United States, although there are proposals pending in a number of cities, including Baltimore, to try to create safe consumption facilities. The research evidence is quite strong that safe consumption facilities are associated with major drops in overdoses in the communities where they're present, and greater use of drug treatment. So this is not an either-or situation. You can provide both harm reduction and drug treatment. The second to final thing I want to talk about is changing the way we talk about the epidemic. This is really important, that there's a lot of terminology that is in widespread use right now that perpetuates stigma about people with substance use disorders. We talk about people as if they're criminal, as if they're dirty, and as if they're morally bankrupt. And I'm sure the people on this call do not use those terms, but we do have to be very conscious of the subtly stigmatizing language that is present in terms like get clean, implying that someone might have been dirty before, or simply referring to people as addicts. This is important because we know from experimental research that my colleagues have conducted that the messages that people get about people with opioid use disorders and other substance use disorders frame whether they think that these populations are worth helping through public health interventions. The final thing I want to mention is the creation of multi-sectoral partnerships. So trying to build bridges between law enforcement, public health, treatment providers, and social services. And we now have some models of how this can actually work on the ground. So one to mention is the LEAD program in Seattle, which has really changed how the police interact with people who they used to arrest for simple possession charges of drugs. Instead of sending those people to jail, which then becomes a revolving door, the police now provide an entry point into community services. So diversion is really the key idea here, that people can be helped by sending them to community service providers and to treatment programs. Early evaluations of LEADs have really underscored that it's been helping a lot of people in reducing overdose rates on the street. So just to conclude, there are a number of different ways in which funders can think about this issue, and I really want to stress investing in capacity, not just service delivery. I think it's important to spend more on service delivery. More people need services, but we're not going to see sustained changes until we have system capacity to really coordinate how people are moving across a variety of different prevention, treatment, and harm reduction strategies. The other thing I want to mention is to focus on key intervention points. For example, we know that the first week from when people leave jail is a time when their risk of overdosing and dying goes up very, very much. So if we know that there are critical periods where we can help people, we should really focus from a public health perspective on those critical periods. Educating policymakers and the public is something that can really be important to the broader strategy to build on the point about changing the way that we talk about the epidemic. And then finally, just to say that I think that we need to think long term. If we can slow down the spread of this epidemic, that's going to be fantastic, but there's going to be a large intergenerational overhang here. There's a lot of children, for example, right now who have parents who are suffering from opioid use disorders, and so we're going to see sort of long-term repercussions of this epidemic even once we hopefully manage to contain the overdose rate. So I think having a long-term perspective is something that can really pay off. And that concludes my comments, so I really thank you for your time.
Thank you, Brendan. Thanks so much. I'm going to turn it over to Joni. We've asked Joni to speak a little bit about the work of Stanton Farm and some opportunities for philanthropy to play a role in this. Joni?
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for that great presentation, Brendan. It was really very helpful, and I'm sure people will get a lot of mileage from it. So before I start my comments, I did want people to think about not only what are you currently doing, but think about what you could be doing or might be interested in doing, so that after this call, if there is an interest in taking further steps, we will be able to do that. Let me first also mention that in the state of Pennsylvania, the state has, as most people probably know, the Department of Drug and Alcohol is a separate department from the Department of Human Services. And until now, the opinion or the direction of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs has focused strictly on abstinence. And that's been a detriment to the state. That has absolutely changed in the past couple of months. And as you probably all know, there's talk about integrating those two and three other human service organizations under one umbrella. The other thing that the state has done is they put in about $34 million for centers of excellence, which are basically health homes for people who are addicted. There are 50 centers across the state, the east part and the west part. The east part, of course, has the most, southwest part second most. Also, I'll finally add that Pennsylvania has a good neighbor law so that if someone is using drugs and they overdose and a friend is there, whether they're using or not, and they call the police to save the person who's overdosing, the person who made the call will not be arrested. For so many people who overdose, there are other people in the room, but they're afraid to call the police because they're afraid that they will get arrested. Suing the drug companies is a topic that people have been talking about recently, by the way, because especially as what Brendan was saying about how the epidemic started with, frankly, big pharmaceutical companies telling doctors in the 1950s and 60s that opioids were non-addictive has contributed to this epidemic. And if you haven't read the book Dreamland yet by Sam Quinones, I highly recommend it. He talks about the economics of how opioids and black tar heroin came about in this country, and it is a fascinating read. It is not about people's experiences. It's all about how this pipeline came to this country. So now I'll move on to what Staunton Farm has been doing, just as an example of things that can be done that we've been doing for a while. So one method of getting opioids off the streets are these take-back drug boxes. And the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency, PCCD, has led an effort that I know that they have close to 400 take-back boxes in Pennsylvania. I know in our area, because we funded it, there's about 120 of them. And what they are is they look like mailboxes, and they are stationed in community buildings, mostly police stations. And they're not trying to attract, although they'd be happy if you did, illegal drugs, but they're trying to attract people who have all these opioids in their medicine cabinet from the prescription that they got for something they needed for a week, but now they have 3 weeks of opioids left. It's not safe to flush opioids down the toilet. It's not good for the water supply. So they've started these take-back the drug boxes, no questions asked, and it's really just to reduce those leaky medicine cabinets, and I love that term. So another thing that the Staunton Farm Foundation has funded through the PA district attorneys is distribution of naloxone or Narcan. And that is, as Brendan was talking about, something that is very much needed in the community. There's a lot of stigma around it because some people's attitudes are, I don't know why we're bringing these people back because they're just going to come back dead the next time. And I tell you this almost verbatim out of the mouth of a resident that was treating a friend of mine who had OD'd. So there's still a lot of controversy out there, but everyone is getting their kits, including, as we saw in one of the first slides, the parks and the park rangers. Certainly they have been distributed to police stations. Now they're being distributed into schools, which I think is a great idea because a lot of kids in high schools are using. About 15 years ago, needle exchange became legal in Pennsylvania. It used to be illegal to give out clean needles, but it's no longer that way. And in Pittsburgh, I know we have an organization called Prevention Point Pittsburgh, and one of the things that they do and have been doing for probably 25 years is doing needle exchange. I'm sure they have something in other parts of the state. And that's a place that not only, you know, you can go and exchange needles, but it's also a place where you can get resources. They practice harm reduction. So that if you go there and you are, you know, you can pick up literature, you can talk to people, you can, you know, get all sorts of resources that you can act on or not and take and know about for the future. We've also been funding some medicated assisted treatment facilities. One is it's a youth serving organization as well as adults to provide Suboxone treatment for their clients over 18 years old. We've also helped put in medicated assisted treatment in a federally qualified health center a little bit outside of Pittsburgh. And probably one of the most exciting things we are doing is we gave a grant for a startup for a program called My New Leaf, which is a web-based addiction recovery application for millennials to help provide resources and aid in the recovery efforts of drug and alcohol and substance use and their families and professionals who serve them. I can't tell you the outcome because we haven't received their final report yet, but let's just say they're coming back and asking us for another grant. And then something that is somewhat related, not exactly with opioid addiction, but the Secretary of the Department of Corrections, his name is John Wetzel, has joined a national initiative called Stepping Up. And Stepping Up is a program that will be driven by individual communities to help identify people who are in the criminal justice system that have mental illness and substance use disorders. Believe it or not, I don't know about the rest of the state, but we don't know how many people in our Allegheny County Jail have mental illness. So I know that in Philadelphia, I know a number of communities across the country, including, I believe it's 13 counties in Pennsylvania, have already signed up to be a part of this initiative. So look for that in your communities because you may find that that's an area that you might be interested in at least participating in. Actually, that's not finally. The final thing I have to say is everybody's trying to do something about this problem, this crisis, and that's a good thing, but I do believe there's a lack of coordination. I like to say everybody's doing nothing. Everybody has their own group, and people are not talking to each other about it. And I think that I'm really glad we're doing this webinar for the opportunity for us to talk about what as funders we may find useful and helpful in reducing and eliminating this crisis. So as I said when I started a few minutes ago, I was curious to know what things other people are doing or what things other people are seeing or interested in doing so that we can open up a discussion or, well, any other questions.
Thank you, Joni. So with that, we will open up for questions, or if you have anything to share about work that you know is happening or that you're engaged in. So we'll open it for participation. If you want to raise your hand, I'll call on you, and we can invite you to join us. Becca, I see your hand is raised. If you hit star 7, you can unmute the line and ask your question. Becca, if you're having trouble with the audio, you can also type us the question. I also see Mickey Gula, you have your hand raised. If you'd like to share anything, hit star 7 to unmute and ask your question.
We're having some technical problems.
Okay, I'm going to do a dangerous thing here. I'm going to unmute everyone.
Get off your phones.
Might be a technical glitch here, so I'm going to unmute and just we'll just be.
The conference has been unmuted.
So this is Becca.
Becca,
hear me
there
now?
You are.
Great. Star 7 didn't seem to work. That great presentations by both of you. I guess what we're seeing here, and I'm in central Pennsylvania, is that our county coroners who are, you know, scooping people up on the heels of this growing epidemic are saying that, you know, it really is the street heroin that they're seeing now. It's no longer the proliferation of prescription painkillers unless it's an intended suicide by someone with prescription painkillers. So it does seem like the work with physicians is working in terms of drying up that supply, but that the supply of street heroin is growing, and we're hearing, you know, from substance abuse providers that they're seeing teens who are starting with heroin. You know, these are people who don't have chronic pain issues. It's access to a highly addictive drug in a setting where they can get it. And so for us, that begins to mean a whole different set of new strategies that are needed around some of this, especially with prevention. I'd be interested if any of you had comments or thoughts on that.
I'll take a stab at the first half and just comment on the fact that anybody who is becoming a serious addict with opioids may start with prescription painkillers, but they are quickly moving to heroin, with Vicodin costing almost, you know, $80 or $100, one pill on the street. That adds up pretty quickly compared to the stamp bag of heroin that you can get for $5 or $10.
So, Brendan, in addition to Joni's comment, can you share what you're seeing communities doing related to building access to treatment? I mean, it sounds like, Becca, that, you know, you have a capacity issue for treatment. So maybe solutions 2 and solution 4 on, you know, how do you find different ways to talk about the epidemic would be important to think about. You know, as we go from it being a prescription drug issue to a street drug issue, the language might have to change. And Brendan, can you comment on that?
Well, absolutely. I think that the treatments that I was alluding to, so buprenorphine and methadone maintenance as being treatments that have the highest standard of evidence, are both quite effective for people who have addiction to heroin as they are to people who have addiction to pain relievers. So the good news is that the treatments that we have available work for both populations. In terms of building capacity, you know, I will invoke again the Vermont example of the hub and spoke model as being one promising way to connect those community-based buprenorphine providers. So clearly in communities where the epidemic is hitting hardest, a lot of family physicians and internists realize that their patients are suffering and want to do something about it, but may feel uncertain about how to get into prescribing buprenorphine. So what we really need to do is think about building out a treatment system that takes advantage of our primary care providers while also providing a strong linkage to the opioid treatment programs, which may be the most appropriate level of care for some patients.
Yeah, that's helpful. You know, when we started in on this work late in the game, and when we did, we thought if we could just do more to cut off the supply of prescription painkillers coming out of physicians' offices, you know, we would have tackled so much of it. But, you know, now that we're seeing so much of the supply being street, you know, heroin coming up through a pipeline, you know, through the Northeast Corridor into our rural communities, that's a whole different thing.
I think one of Brendan's comments that would be important to comment on here is that, you know, the strategy related to prescription, the practice of prescribing and then of monitoring, to your point, I think we've been successful on that, and, you know, we need to be committed to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as he commented later in the presentation, that this is a problem now that has, you know, greater reach, and it's going to take longer-term solutions. So I think as we are successful in one strategy, in the prescribing practices of physicians and in the monitoring of them, we have to continue to do that and then be reminded now that because of, you know, how deep the problem is and how pervasive, that even though we've kind of checked a box, we probably need to develop other strategies, which obviously can be demoralizing to communities. But I think it's important to say, to get the word out, I think the point Brendan made is that we are seeing successes. And, you know, what I appreciate about the presentation, and then also appreciate all the work that Joni and Staunton Farm has been doing out in the western part of the state, is that if we do this well, if we build on evidence, we can begin to see improvement. You know, it's not going to go away in a season, but I think the good news is there is change already begun on some practices. So the concept of best practices is going to be really important to us.
Thanks. That's all very helpful.
This is Brendan. I just am noticing that Cabrera Rogers has posed a couple of questions on the chat that I just want to address quickly. So one is there any research about the effects of methadone or buprenorphine or other medications that may be prescribed? And other medications that may be prescribed for mental health? Well, I think that the answer to that is that the largest area of concern is using those medication-assisted treatments concurrently with benzodiazepines, which are sometimes used for anxiety. I won't speak to this as if I'm a clinician, but I do know that that is an issue that has to be carefully managed. I don't know of any other mental health medications. And then the other question that Cabrera asked is there any insight about therapy in conjunction with medical-assisted treatment centers? Counseling can be very effective as an adjunct to medication-assisted treatment. And this is a general comment I want to make about treatment, is that treatment is very effective, but what we see is that, unfortunately, treatment is often underfunded, and so there's not an appropriate supply of really highly credentialed mental health professionals available to do things like counseling. And so in addition to thinking about expanding the quantity of treatment, expanding the quality of treatment is a really key goal, and we need to also be very mindful of what the right quality metrics are.
Mm-hmm. Mickey, I see your hand still raised. Are you able to access audio to ask? Okay, so Sue Tresider also has her hand raised. Sue, are you with us?
Mm-hmm.
I think Mickey and Sue are connected over the internet, it looks like. You're not on the audio call. So if you have a question you'd like to have asked, I think the audio must not be working on that part. So if you'd want to type the question, we'll get to it.
This is Joe. The other piece that we can also, I'm assuming Brendan would be available, that if people had a specific question that they wanted to send over to him, the last slide has his email address, not to inundate him with questions, but I'm sure that he would be happy to answer questions, as well as if we share the questions with the group, since we're having a little technical problem here. You know, we could do some follow-up Q&A, Jen. Brendan,
yeah.
would that be okay with you?
That's fine.
Going to do a follow-up email that will have Brendan's contact information and some additional resources, and we'll be able to find out if anyone had any questions that they didn't get to ask today during that time.
So, Brendan, we've got another minute before we have to get off the phone here. Is there any last-minute thoughts that you'd want to drive home here as we head off the call?
I really want to build on this idea that it's going to be maximally helpful if everybody knows what everyone else is doing. This is an issue that has unfortunately been far too siloed for far too long, and one thing that I was really excited about in coming to the call today is knowing that this wasn't just going to be a call of health funders. I think health funders are hugely important in this space, but this is an issue where everybody should have a seat at the table. We should think about really being more bold and innovative about forging connections across criminal justice, across education, across social services and human services, because these populations don't just live within the medical system. Their needs are more complex than that. So, you know, I think that the slogan "No Wrong Door" should really be a slogan that we can carry into addressing the opioid epidemic as well. That no matter where someone goes to get services or resources, that is also a place where they can get help if they have an opioid use problem.
And this is Joni, and fortunately, it's also become a highly political, people are using it to their political advantage. You know, the mayor is having this, and the senator is having that, and the commissioners are having a forum, and that, not that those are bad things, but it oftentimes doesn't include the people that should be included.
So I know, Jen, you're going to want to close this out, but I guess from the Scattergood perspective, again, I want to thank Brendan and the work that the center does, and also thank Joni for the leadership that she's demonstrating in the grant making that they've been doing out in the western part of the state. And I hope that this is a conversation that we'll all keep having, and you know, look forward to the next conversation on this. So, just want to thank the two regional associations for putting this together and supporting this topic.
And to you too, Joe. Thank you.
All. Thank you, Brendan, Joni, Joe, for serving as resources for us, and we will certainly do some follow-up communication where we try to get more of a handle on the work everyone's doing, and maybe try to pull us together again. I just wanted to mention that the Pennsylvania Philanthropy Public Policy Conference is May 1st in Harrisburg. It's still open for registration. You're still able to do that. And this is something that's going to be discussed there as well. But we will continue to follow up with this group around this set of issues. So that's it. That concludes the call for today. Keep your eye out for information on more topics for the Keystone Policy Series. We'll be coming up with more things after the policy conference in Harrisburg, and we'll communicate that with this group. And please, when we do send the follow-up email, your response is really greatly appreciated so that we can keep everyone included on what's happening and hopefully move forward together. So that's it. Thank you,
Jenny.
All.